Play with Pain. Hosted by Emmy-winning comedian and writer Jeff Cesario. Interviewing guests from comedy, entertainment, and sports. Plus, legendary sportscaster Chet Waterhouse. Don't worry, this shouldn't take longer than your average trip to Costco. And now, here's your host, Jeff.
How do you go from a 13-week fill-in on Conan? You got one shot, 13 weeks. It goes well. They want to keep you. Now they keep you. What kind of contract do you get? When do you get comfortable enough to go, I'm going to pitch this lunatic idea I have and see if they can do it? And they start to rely on you more and more for that.
That's a great question, Jeff. Like, I think it was always such an experimental place, and everything was so, because it was a show every day, it felt like kind of a laboratory. Like, we were almost up in an attic being left alone to just throw stuff at the wall.
That's the best.
It really was a luxury to be able to operate, like, where I didn't feel like we were under much scrutiny. And we were just basically, you couldn't get too precious with ideas, whether they worked or didn't work. You were just having to throw something up there every night. And I remember, I think one of the sketches that is one of the reasons I got kept on was during that first 13 weeks, I wrote a sketch. I had a germ of an idea, and it was just to have Andy Richter have a little sister who had a crush on Conan. And it ended up being the brilliant Amy Poehler, who I knew from Chicago. And I was originally going to get a 13-year-old girl, you know, a real 13-year-old girl. And then we were like, I was talking with John Groff, the head writer, and we were like, could Amy look 13? And we're like, once we get put in the pigtails and braces, she totally did.
Yeah.
And her performance was so, I owe her so much from that, because she took a basic idea, a very simple idea, and her performance took it up, elevated it to such a point that it turned into a memorable sketch that I think, I was never told this, but I think it's one of the reasons they wanted to possibly keep me on, because, and then that gave me some confidence to try pitching other character ideas and other, but it was always, I got to say, it was always a very, even early on, I felt encouraged to toss stuff in, and I saw everyone else doing that. And you could tell from things like Tommy doing the gaseous wiener or Brian McCann doing Loser at the Beach, you know, these crazy characters, they were very, they were just throwing stuff at the wall. And so you didn't really worry about it too much or agonize over it. It was like, hey, what the hell? Let's try it. And so that was a luxury to be able to come into that environment with a bunch of people who I shared that kind of sensibility from Chicago with a lot of these people. And Conan's an improviser himself. And Steven, working with Steven, is very similar to that too. They love to just, they like when things go off the rails. They like when things get a little, like takes a left turn that we weren't expecting it, and having to try to put it back on the tracks is half the fun for them. So
yeah. And Amy Poehler's commitment level in that bit, playing Andy's younger sister who has a crush on Conan, is so off the charts. I would literally have to go back to maybe Dan Aykroyd for that level of pure, unadulterated, straight in the main vein commitment. I mean, I was at home and I got thrown back a little bit in my chair going, holy crap. First of all, I didn't know who she was. And I'm like, wow, whoever this is so completely committed to it. There is no chance it's not going to work.
That's so great to hear, Jeff, because I always felt the same way about Amy, even back in Chicago. She was always, I remember I saw her for the first time at I.O., you know, on stage. And the first night I saw her was also the first night I saw Tina Fey. They were in the same Improv Olympic team.
Wow.
And Tina was always brilliant, but she was kind of reserved and kind of would step in and say something brilliant and Dorothy Parker-like and incredibly genius. And then she would step back. Amy seemed fully formed from day one. Like, I don't remember her having an arc of getting, she just seemed like spring fully formed from the head of the improv gods or something. Tina was always brilliant, but Amy always.
Amy's grain alcohol. She is just pure grain alcohol from the get.
She really did seem that she was fully committed in everything I ever saw her do, and she can do anything. And, you know, one of the things I feel bad about in retrospect was I hadn't done any bits in the audience myself yet. So I thought we shouldn't have cue cards for Amy for that bit because everyone's going to see all the jokes and they're going to see what's coming. And to have her do those bits with no cue cards is insane.
You can't do it. It can't.
And
be
she
that.
Did it. She did it.
Wow.
That's... And we would have rewrites and she would still not miss a line. And
that's
she
impressive.
Would, and I think back on it now and I'm just like so embarrassed that I was like, I realized later, most of the audience doesn't look at the cards anyway. They're looking at the monitors to see the
right.
sketch. And they're looking to see what's on the TV and they're looking at the actors. And it was ridiculous for me, but I just didn't know. And I feel bad, but she nailed it anyway. So
when do you get to a place where you say to yourself, I'm actually going to pitch me for this idea? You have an advantage, which you've mentioned, which is you have to have a short memory when you're doing 4 or 5 nights a week, 5 shows a week. You got to be able to go, that was brilliant. Yeah, well, you got to do it again tonight. That sucked. Forget it. You got to do it again tonight. So you've got that advantage where at some point you got to be able to say, hey, guys, how about me for this? Do you remember what popped into your head where you had the balls to go, I could do this one?
That's a good question, Jeff. Like it took a long time for me to feel confident to pitch myself for stuff. Like I would usually, if I was in bits early on, it was someone else asking me to come in as a doctor or come in as this or whatever. And I'm trying to think. I remember Brian McCann had the idea for me originally to play Frankenstein because I'm kind of tall and awkward but then I ended up writing some Frankenstein bits later on, but Brian thought of me to play Frankenstein. And then I think I remember Andrew Weinberg suggested, hey, how about Stack, we have you play an old-timey salesman, you know. Oh, so I did the traveling salesman.
But great.
I wrote that with Andrew and Michael Komen. We would write those bits together, but I have Andrew to thank for pitching me for that. The Ghost Crooner, I remember, I think that was one where I actually thought maybe I could do it because I had the idea.
Explain the germ of that idea and how it grows into, when does the bizarre left turn come into that? And take us through that and what that turn was.
I think what that came from was, first of all, I realized one day, I was like, wow, Rockefeller Center's been here since 1930 or so. And so there was all these radio singers that used to sing there, like Bing Crosby and stuff. And I remember also hearing that Bing Crosby had this dark side, you know, he had this, you know, hey, Junior kind of persona, but he was also could be like just this unspeakable, horrible guy in other ways, you know.
Right.
I started to think, what if there's a guy who's awful, but he sounds like, you know, just, hey, how's it going? And so I started to think about a guy having a really dark undercurrent. And also we'd done a bit where Andy was kind of half faded away. And all it required was a lockdown shot of a empty chair faded in over a live shot of Andy. And I was like, that's really all you have to do to fade someone in and out. So we half faded me in as the ghost. And I realized you could make something appear like a ghost. And it's really not a big technical trick. It's very easy to do.
Suddenly realized you're not pitching a $53,000 CGI bit, but you're pitching something that costs a nickel.
Exactly.
It took off with it.
Yeah, it was that simple. And so, and then I do remember thinking later on after I did it a few times, the crooner, if I'd known I was going to do it more than once, I would have at least varied the melody of the song because it's always the same damn song.
No, but I think that's part of the joke for me.
Oh, thanks.
It's like the dude knows one tune.
That was it. And I always try to make it clear that he'd been murdered by like the League of Women Voters. And, like, he was just this horrible racist misogynist monster.
He would start by, he would, the ghost crooner would just sort of come upon Conan. And he would respond as if it was just this ghost who lived in the studio and sang, and you would start to sing, and then like the lyrics would go off just horrifically off the rails.
Right. It was just he obviously, you know, was a bigot and a misogynist and like thought the the Irish had brains made of corn, and I always tried to, I always, you know, try to go after my own people, the Irish, with it, and go after
Sure.
Conan people, to, you know, don't want to be attacking other groups and stuff. But,
Right.
and I would always, yeah, I would always try to, it's always fun too, to have like Conan have to say, all right, I'll listen to one more song, which why is he letting him sing another one? But I would always be like, how about a sweet little one for the ladies?
And you go, oh, all right. Yeah. It's such a great, bit, because it relies on obscure but still trustworthy comedy saws, if you will, you know, comedy scaffolding. Like nobody does that anymore. The old, like, there's no way you would let this bit go on.
Right.
But comedically, there's a beat where the guy is, all right, I'll try one more. You know, Conan does those things, and nobody really does those anymore. And I love that, like these obscure little comedy muscles. And you go, yeah, let's do that and run another three freaking songs out of this guy.
And I'll always be grateful to him for being willing to be the straight man in a lot of these bits, because, you know, as brilliant as he, you know, Stephen too, like his willingness to be a straight man in bits where someone will come out and do stuff when they're two of the funniest guys, you know, in the world.
Right.
But
and quickest,
sometimes
yeah.
It requires them to just be the audience and be the voice of reason listening to this insanity. And there were some times where Conan would jokingly say, you guys turned me into Mr. Mooney today. With, you know, if anyone remembers from the old Lucy show, Mr. Right. Mooney's just getting, this is outrageous, you know. And it's like, it's just the complete straight man who isn't getting, it was just reacting to the madness.
Right, right.
You know? Stop this at once, you know, that kind of thing.
So now, do you get enough satisfaction doing that level of performing, occasionally popping up on Conan, having some recurring characters that people are kind of looking forward to? Or do you still have to scratch that itch somewhere else or somehow else?
Well, you know, I always love doing improv shows, even like on weekends in New York. Like I'd go do the Ask Cat show
great.
With all the UCB friends. And that was always like just like a Chicago reunion every week. We'd like, and with a lot of New York people that were never even in Chicago. But when I first got to New York in 97, going to do Ask Cat on Sunday nights was such a thrill. And then I used to do a lot of outside voiceover work, which I really enjoyed doing. And then I would get to do occasionally little guest things, you know, and like friends would ask me to do a little bit thing in their show, or, you know, like I'd come in and like I got to do a few little guest bits on like Parks and Rec and 30 Rock, and did one thing on The Office and stuff. And that was always a thrill, even though they were very, very minor little supporting roles. It was such a treat to go in and see how they do the show, and
right.
And also it was such a lovely thing to see the tone that people like Amy was at Park, where it wasn't a surprise to me, but how that it all trickles down from whoever's like the lead voice of the show. And that's why I think that show had one of the reasons it had so much heart to it. And such a sense of fun and family. And you see it in the cast when they're doing the show. And it's because that was all on the set, even when the cameras weren't rolling. Like Amy would set that kind of tone, and
right, yeah,
it's 30 Rock too. You know,
you can, you know, when you're in a creative and supportive environment, and when you're in a fear-based environment. And in show business, ironically, they both work. They will both get successful product in front of the cameras. But if you're writing on it, you know, and you're in a fear-based environment, it's hell, man.
I'm
sure. Like, oh my God, why do you have to be there? And the fear and panic combined creates an environment. And I've only sort of guested in rooms that have been like that. But the second I see it, I like take a step back and go, I couldn't do that anyway. I tried a couple times early in my career to survive those. And then I just went, all right, fear-based, I can't really function in that. So I'm just going to step back and put up the, you know, the shields, the Star Trek shields, and just do the best I can. But it works. It still gets product in front of the camera that people find funny, especially funny.
Yeah, I'm always amazed because I haven't had to work in a one of those terror based writers rooms, but I do know that I've heard about shows that have done quite well with that environment, and that baffles me because I personally don't think I could function either in that kind of environment. Like it, I don't see how people like. I was one of my favorite shows of all time. You worked on the Larry Sanders Show, and you know it's one of the genius shows of all time, and I think it's one of the greatest shows ever made, and it's and the ensemble element of the entire cast feeling like all my favorite shows, there's that element where no one, like everyone's serving the overall piece as opposed to trying to serve themselves.
Right.
And that's like why it's so great, because if it's requiring the main character to just hang back and let someone else shine in that scene, that's what's best for the show. So that's what happens.
Right.
You know, and
yeah.
There's other shows where someone, the main star is like, I'm the only one who shines, you know?
Right.
And
right, yeah,
that ends up kind of, I think, having a detrimental effect on a show a lot of the time.
Eventually, I believe it has a detrimental effect immediately on what is now called the work personal life balance, work home life balance. Which, if we would have had that term 25 years ago, I might have survived better. But nobody thought of that. They just went, shut the fuck up and keep writing. When you're on a set like that and Rip Torn takes a step back and goes, well, Jeffrey Tambor, this is your thing. Shine here. I'll maneuver this way so you can get what you need. And you're like, this is Rip Torn and Jeffrey Tambor, who are two of the most, you know, two of the greatest actors, quite frankly, that America, if you listed 100 actors, they'd probably both be on it.
Yeah.
And you're going, okay, well, I can probably go back to my office and shut the hell up and just work on my next script until it's good. So it feeds off, that energy does feed off itself. And I'm sure you experienced that at Conan and now at Colbert.
Absolutely. I think that the environments are very similar in the sense that, like, there tends to, people, you know, this may sound very Pollyannish, but it's honestly very true. Most of the people I've gotten to work with have been really nice people who love what they do and love and just are trying to make the whole show good. And, you know, and everybody's trying. And that goes from, like, I think about people like our costume designers, like Scott Cronick at Conan, you know, or Antonia, you know, at Colbert, like they make everything better and they save your butt so often and no one knows who they are. And that kills me because like our prop guy, Bill Tull from Conan, who just passed away, who used to do on camera bits a lot.
Yeah.
There's no way to overstate how much he saved our ass and like the lengths to which he would go to get it. Like, I'll never forget early on, I had an idea during a staring contest bit at Conan for Andy Daly was playing Hamlet and he had a York skull. And I said to Bill, I said, is there any way for a tongue to come out of a skull and for Hamlet to start making out with the skull? And he goes, yeah, no problem. And I'm like, and he made a skull with a little latch on the bottom for Andy to flip it. So the tongue would come out and French kiss the skull. And on my last day at Conan, I swear this is true. I was saying, Bill, I can't even begin to thank you for all the stuff you did for us. And I even remember this skull with a tongue back in New York. And he goes, oh, yeah. And later that day, he came in and gave me the skull. He had it.
Wow.
I couldn't believe
impressive.
He had it. He goes, oh, yeah, I never throw anything away. And
that's so sweet.
That thing had traveled across the country to Los Angeles. And those people save, you know, there's so many unsung heroes at the shows. And
I think people at home don't necessarily see clearly what goes into it because it looks rough and kind of thrown together and you're kind of hoping it is so that it frays a little bit at the edges and gets even funnier. But it's day in and day out. It's like triage comedy producing.
Absolutely.
You know, I need a board that that can blow out into a peacock tail. All right, you know, and he's got to look like suddenly a drip of blood has to come from his tongue. Can we do? I mean, you know, it's just craziness that. And when you have a team like that, that's yes, and that literally is the basic premise of improv, but from wardrobe, from makeup, from production, wow, it just makes the difference. It makes all the difference in the world to go get a laugh.
Absolutely. And just a quick example, Bill once, they had an idea for going to be shearing a sheep, and then they cut away and they cut back and a sheep skeleton went far. And Bill, so had to get a sheep skeleton, and he's like, well, where am I going to find that? So Bill went out to New Jersey to a sheep farm and dug up a skeleton with a backhoe, had to bring it back, boil it, reassemble the sheep skeleton for a sight gag. That was about a second long. And like, that's just an example of like all these things. No one knows how much work goes into these things. All we know is we show up at work and there's a sheep skeleton, you know?
And this is precisely, this exact example is precisely why when a bit like that doesn't get a laugh, every writer in the room buckles over in hysterical laughter. That's exactly why.
Exactly. We Andrew Weinberg, you know, one of our writers used to joke that there's a direct correlation between the amount of work you ask other departments to do and how poorly a bit will end going. So it's like the more, a lot of times the simplest ideas work the best, and the other ones where you're like, I want you to spend all night making, you know, a parade float, and it's like, oh, that sucks. And that's often the case. You know,
I could never take that pressure. When I worked at Queen Latifah's daytime show, I said, and I started to get good at it, I said, just give me the nickel bits. Give me the bits that where you go, well, we don't have any money. Can you come up with something in 8 minutes? Yes, that I can do. Give me a folding chair and the premise of the voice. And I, you know, I wound up writing a bit where Queen Latifah wound up being the fourth judge, but they'd run out of chair money.
And oh, so that's
she got
great.
A folding chair. So, you know, I said that I can do. If it involves production, I can't do it. I can't bring myself to spend money.
I totally relate, Jeff. I used to feel so guilty about, you know, wasting money or wasting, even though we're a low budget show, you know. You always feel bad if you feel like you've wasted people's time.
Yeah. What's your biggest gear shift from Conan to Colbert? Because they're different shows with different emphasis, and especially Conan, who kind of stayed, you know, in an arena where maybe you could play a little more. And Colbert, who's going mainstream 11:30, yet still wants to do some stuff that pushes the envelope. For you as a writer, what was the toughest shift?
The most challenging, the fun challenge was shifting into writing more politically based humor. Because like at Conan, most of the stuff we did that touched on politics was tended to be very silly, and I don't mean that in a negative way, just
right,
you know, it was like Smigel or me or McCann doing like those lips, you know, right. Smigel doing Clinton going yeah, you know, that was like, or you know, or him doing Arnold Schwarzenegger, or you know, and so it tended to be, you know, more cartoonish and silly, and Steven has a wonderful silly sense of humor and loves silly, but the monologue is also such a larger chunk of the show,
right.
And the emphasis of the show at the Late Show. So that's been an interesting challenge because there's so much more emphasis on the monologue at like at Conan. I almost never even worked on monologue stuff. That was like a few other guys like Brian Kiley and Laurie Kilmartin. And, you know, those guys who would just work on, cause Conan would usually only do, you know, several monologue jokes. And then we'd get over to the desk piece and
right.
But the monologue is such a larger part of the Late Show. And also, you know, none of us, like when Stephen took over the Late Show in 2015, none of us saw like Trump coming or anything like that. So none of us really knew what was in store and what the national mood was going to be. So it was an interesting challenge to shift into more topical political stuff as opposed to silly character-based stuff, which is kind of was my entire background, even in Chicago. But it was an interesting challenge. And I work with such, you know, some just people who are so naturally good at writing that kind of stuff that I just try to contribute where I can and come in and do, and I enjoy doing some performing stuff. And I really do enjoy bouncing ideas off of them, even though some of them are so much more suited to political humor than I am. I do my best to rise to the challenge, but it was definitely a real shift, you know, in terms of the kind of material that we were doing.
Nothing helps a shift like that, like just a good fun writer's room where there's some trust there and the ball busting is done in a benevolent way all around the room and everybody's getting it. It's just a great feeling. Just great. Well, look, we've barely touched on sports. And before we do, you bring up the talking, the lips on the Conan show that were inside headshots.
Yeah, the Clutch Cargo, which is a reference to an old bit on Ray Rain.
And did you literally have to set your head in a brace? How did they shoot that?
Yeah, it was a locked on camera, and Smigel, Robert Smigel, did about, I'd say, 90% of the lips. But I remember going to see the show in 94, 3 years before I worked there. Andy got me tickets, and I remember saying, oh, that's how they do it, because they had Robert. And I think Robert, one of the genius things he said was, the audience will enjoy seeing the process of how we do this. So they kept the curtain open, so you'd see, you know, Robert just doing it and resting his chin on a thing. And I did the same thing when I did voices for it. Like, if they had me do like Mike Tyson or Martha Stewart or something, I would just like put my chin on the thing. And sometimes Robert would be right next to me, and but you had to kind of keep your face still.
Right.
And it must be a camera on your lips. And then they would key it into the face of the picture. And it was a really simple, fun way to do goofy impressions, because it was it was so low tech, you know.
those are the best. And you're the guy they go to. Your range is Mike Tyson to Martha Stewart.
Well, Robert did, like, I think Smigel did, God, he did everything from Schwarzenegger to Bush to Barbara Bush. I remember.
And how much fun is he to work with?
Oh, he's a blast.
Yeah.
I only got to work with Robert when he would come in. I was never head writer at Conan when I worked there, but he would come in to do Triumph and Clutch Cargo bits.
Oh,
and
God.
He was, I always knew of Robert's reputation and how brilliant he was, but he was so fun to work with when writing the Clutch Cargo bits and rewrite, because he just really just wants everything to be as funny as possible. And he's so fearless. Like, I've been on shoots with him.
Oh my
where
God.
He's doing Triumph, and the guy has no fear at all. He'll go up to, like, I remember being at the Video Music Awards where he was trying to get into Insult NSYNC, and he was trying to get past their huge bodyguards. And there was a bodyguard who looked like a mountain, you know, who was just standing there. And Robert was trying to do Triumph over the guy's shoulder to yell it in sync. And the guy turns around and goes, back off, man. And Robert goes, I'm just making jokes. And the guys go, can't make jokes with a broken jaw. And but Robert was willing. Robert would get his jaw That's broken great. If he could get an extra joke. You know, he's just one of those.
Wow.
He's utterly, utterly fearless. And I admire that, and super funny, and you know, but he'll also stay up all night. We did a Wiener Circle bit in Chicago with Jack McBrayer, where he was in the hot dog place where that they pride themselves on insulting everybody. And I think they left at like 5:30 a.m. I left at like 3, and I was beat, you know. But he'll stay all night to get extra.
Yeah. That's impressive. Yeah. Now, how does a guy like Andy Richter, who has incredible comedy chops, how is he able to literally reshape the role of the traditional sidekick, as it were? And we got to go back to when they started in the early 90s on NBC, when the model was Ed McMahon. There wasn't really, only SCTV had done a version of a talk show, an entire parody of a talk show, where John Candy played William B. Williams, the incredibly suck-ass sidekick to why am I blanking?
Sammy Maudlin.
Sammy Maudlin. Thank you.
Joe Player.
So there's really no role models for Andy to go, okay, I got to make this real, but I can't just, you know, I've got to change this somehow. I can't believe the job he did on it. It's stunning.
It was stunning to me too. And like, I knew Andy, you know, in Chicago, as I mentioned, and I knew how funny he was. I knew that when I started watching the show, when he started doing it with Conan, that it was really just Andy being Andy. And I think that was the key. He wasn't trying to be someone else or be a typical psychic. He was just being Andy talking to Conan. And that's why I think Robert suggested having him sit down with him one day at rehearsal, because Andy was hired as a writer on the show and didn't know he was going to be a sidekick. But Conan was so tickled by Andy and obviously found him so funny and loved how honest he was and how he would kind of, like, one thing about Conan is that he loves people who call him on stuff. Like, that's like his wife Liza or his assistant Sona. They call him out on, like, you're being a neurotic idiot, you know, or they'll, or Andy will say, like, stop it, you know?
Right.
And
right.
He loves that because, you know, he, you know, like most comedians, we're all full of self-loathing. And like, when someone calls you on your shit, you're like, yes, I love this guy. And so he loved Andy from the beginning. And I think Robert sensed that and said, hey, why don't you sit down and keep him company, you know, during this test show. And I think it was just very natural and real. And Andy was really just being Andy. And I think that's why it worked, because, you know, he was just, instead of forcing it and trying to be a sidekick in the typical mold, he was just talking to Conan and sitting there and either supporting him or busting his balls, whatever it called
right.
for.
That's, well, it's a great lesson too, to just be organic, be true to whoever you are, and something good.
Yeah, Conan even said that. That's right. Like, I remember, I think Conan said that Johnny Carson even said to him when he was starting the show at late night, he said, I don't know if you can do this or not, but I will say the only way this can work is if you be yourself.
That's fantastic advice.
Yeah. And I thought that was brilliant, because he said, like, you can't like try to be what you've seen before unless it's really the way you really are, you know? So it's like, right. And I thought that was great advice. And like, no one can be a better you than you can, you know? It's, and it may not work, you know, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes brilliant people have failed shows, obviously. And
right.
There's a lot of luck involved in time slot luck. Yeah, I mean, look at the Dana Carvey show, which had one of the most brilliant writing staffs and performing staffs ever. And there's no reason for why that should have not worked.
Yeah,
and, it's just, time slot was bad. And yeah, it was just.
Yeah, there are inclement weather can happen at any time in comedy.
Yeah, there's so much luck involved, you know, and the good and bad, you know.
So what's a moment that you remember from so many years dealing with Conan, who is, you know, we all know, hilarious guy, one of the quickest guys off the top of his head, and, you know, just wildly entertaining. I mean, he got the gig because he was so entertaining in writers' rooms.
Right.
That, you know, eventually Lorne went, well, you could do this.
Yeah, I think that.
he took the shot. And you worked for him a long time, interactions, good, you know, a bit bombing, an incredible interaction, whatever they may be. What pops to mind when you think of Conan?
Well, you know, one of my favorite things was just when he would just come in and riff around with the writers in the room, like he'd have his guitar, or he'd come in and just jokingly, he'll like, stack you alabaster ape. Like, he would just come in and, like, you know, but it was always very affectionate. But he would come in and just, some of my favorite memories are just the silliest bits that don't
so
translate.
Alabaster ape was said with great affection.
Exactly. Okay. And I'm like, I'm certainly no paler than he is, you know, but I was like, but we're both like, people used to think I was his brother when I first started the show, because we're the same height. We got red hair. And but it was funny. I think some of my favorite memories are just that wouldn't translate. I'd come home and try to explain them to my wife, Miriam, or something. And Conan even joked about this on his podcast. He used the example of me trying to go home and tell Miriam a bit from The Office that wouldn't translate at all. But little things, like he would come in and he would have like a little tweed cap, and he would come in and go, My name, good sirs, is Cappy Cap. I am a kind and gentle chap. I hope you have enjoyed my rap. That name again, Cappy Cap. You know, and it's just the stupidest stuff that is. There's a guy who went to Harvard just doing the dumbest thing in the world. Or he would come in after the Yankees won the World Series and be like, with bat and ball, they took the field. With cap and glove, refused to yield. You know, just like Casey at the bat kind of bullshit. That's some of my, and it doesn't translate. Like I try to tell people about it, in the room, he would come in and riff around. And like Brian McCann had a shaved head at one point and he was wearing a white turtleneck. And he comes in and he goes, oh, an egg in an egg cup. You know, and it was just, those were the things I missed the most, would just be literally just coming in and riffing. And he did that constantly. We rarely had a real, that was why it was funny with the day I was my last day leaving Conan, when I asked him for his blessing to, you know, head back east, and he was so kind about it. We actually had a real conversation. And I remember thinking, why does this feel so weird? I'm just having a real earnest conversation with him. Because most of it was always on a bit level, you know, it was always him coming in with a guitar and just making up songs about us and stuff. And because you watch his remotes and you can see that's where he's constantly riffing with strangers. And
and the universal ability to do it in Cuba or you know, Armenia, or is just so much fun to see. So much
it
fun
really is. And I think that the fact that Conan and Steven both are as much writers as they are performers, and they're both so brilliantly funny as writers, that's like so much of the fun of it is you're working with people that are tossing in so many great ideas of their own, and you're like, oh my God, there's a reason why, you know, this person's a famous comedian and hosting the show. But like, there's times where you're like, I think that's one of the reasons both shows you know, found an audience and like found success, was because I don't think it can be overstated how important it is that both those guys are writers as much as they are performers.
Right. Know? That's the thing. And the thing I'll say about Stephen Colbert, only did a short thing with him once for Comedy Central, on which he was hilarious, and on which he also warned me when I finished it. I produced some stuff for an anniversary special of theirs. And halfway through it, I realized, oh, they got me to deal with Dennis Leary and Stephen Colbert and Gilbert and all these guys, because anybody from Comedy Central who walked in, those guys would all go, get out of here. So, but if I were going to go, all right, what do you want to try to do? So I finished the bit and I go, this is going to cut together great. And Colbert said, yeah, wait till Comedy Central gets their hands on it. And sure enough, despite absolute fisticuffs in the edit bay, you know, they owned it, they won, and the bit was just... It came out fine, but it could have been like 90% funnier. But
that wasn't the Chevy Chase roast, was it?
No, it was a called the Bar Mitzvah Bash. It was their 13th anniversary.
Show,
and I went in and did some stuff, and I just so respected his ability to come off the top of his head, and you know, and I've seen some guys who can do that from Dennis Miller on, you know, who can just, you know, Russell Brand, I worked with, guys who just, who bang, it's there.
Yeah.
And Steven was, you know, was right at the top of that list. I mean, I couldn't believe how quick he was. It was really, but first of all, it makes your job so much easier when, you know, all right, maybe I can cobble together some crutch of a setup, and he'll take it from there, you know. So when you're working with Steven, is does that pop up for you?
Oh yeah, like it. I'm constantly amazed at how the ability to improve stuff on the fly, like in the rewrite, or and he and Conan were both amazing at their instincts for what will work, or what, like, you could lose this piece or move this piece, or like, their instincts for improving stuff on the fly is amazing to watch, because I think I'd be kind of going, what do you guys think? What do you think? What do you guys say? What do you think? And you don't always have time for that. So it requires a lot of times just making lightning quick decisions. Okay. It's cut like, that, move that.
Instant, you know, executive producing. It's just like, vroom. It's like they can see it. It's wild. Yeah.
It is, and it's really impressive to watch how lightning quick they are, and you know, it's I think, like I said, the ability to write as well as perform. Like there have been some brilliant hosts that weren't writers at all, you know, or people like I don't believe Sid Caesar was a writer,
right?
But he was an amazing performer.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I'm always impressed when like I find people who did both, you know, because I'm just like, wow, they were the front face of the show, but they also were basically head writers, you know, at the same time, which is what Conan and Stephen have always been. And that's really amazing to me.
Well, my friends, we are done. Folks, it's flown by that fast. We'll probably cut this one into two episodes. My guest, incredibly funny, consistently funny in front of the camera and behind the camera, Brian Stack. Follow him on Twitter at Brian Stack and watch his work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And if you're in New York, you never know. Check out the improv shows. Brian Stack may pop up. Anything else we should know about?
I think you covered it. Thanks, Jeff.
Covered it?
This has been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate you asking me to do it. And it's great to talk to you.
Oh, man. I had a blast. Thanks so much. And indeed, seriously, catch him on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Always funny. Thanks a ton for doing it. Follow me on Twitter at Real Jeff Cesario. My album, What Was I Thinking? Streaming everywhere. The Play With Pain mugs. Oh, yeah, there's mugs. Available at jeffcesario.com. Check my website for any upcoming dates. I'm going to try to get out, do a little road work this fall. Tell your friends about the podcast. We're having a blast. Chet, what do you got cooking? Oh, this week I'll be in Kalonic, Maine, calling the All-You-Can-Eat Lobster Newburgh Festival for the Emesis Network. Take it from me, steer clear of the vomit buckets. Sponsored by Tempur-Pedic, the lightly fried adjustable mattress, and My Pillow Case. Make any pillow your pillow with My Pillow Case. This is Chet Waterhouse reminding you to play with pain.